Well, let's take a look now back 20 years ago, Ireland in 1994.
You know, I've got one friend left from my early 20s who is still the same way. His name is Declan Moffat. And he's still as wild. He comes from Glenamaddy and he's as wild. He has this ferocious kind of sexual energy, but it's not wrapped up in any charm.
Because a lot of the time people lie, you know, when you ask them how they are. You know, if you meet somebody on the street or whatever and say, how are you doing? They say, I'm fine. How are you? And you say, I'm fine. And then you say, see ya. Because you can't really be bothered with human communication a lot of the time, you know. And if you tell people the truth, they can often get very upset. You know, if somebody says, how are you doing? And you say, I'm terrible. I have piles. All my skin is falling off. I live with an old woman I don't really know underground, and I want to die. What will the other person say? They'll just go, oh, okay, see ya. Because they, you know.
Well, it was a time when comedians such as Dylan Moran and Tommy Tiernan were creating classic comedy that would go on to win some of the greatest comedy awards. My next guest saw great potential in it all. He decided it was time to give it a big push, so he set up the Cat Laughs Comedy Festival in Kilkenny, just as the boom in Irish comedy was taking off. Richard Cook, it's kind of hard to believe it was 20 years ago.
I know, and actually, funny enough, listening to those clips, George, it's odd to think that the only Irish comedian that was on the bill in the first year in 1995 was Andrew Maxwell, would you believe? Tommy and Dylan both came in subsequent years. They hadn't really, they may have started, but they were still very, very young in their careers. And yeah, it was odd. Myself and Lynn Cattle were running a theatre company called Bickerstaff, and we'd put on an open-air production of Macbeth at Kilkenny Castle, and it had gone really well. And I suppose the scale of that event really gave us confidence to do something that was, I guess, unique and a bit different. And we hit upon the idea of doing a stand-up comedy festival in Kilkenny, and that was the beginning.
And was there any particular inspiration, or was it that you just wanted to put on a festival? Was it that comedy was it, or was it you were just looking to put on a festival?
I mean, we were looking to put on a festival. I was actually remember
of anything.
Not of anything. It needed to be linked to theatre. I mean, our background, myself and Lynn's background, was in theatre, putting on plays in the back of Clear's new plays, actually. And I suppose I was always attracted to the idea of somebody communicating their ideas to an audience. And therefore, there was a link to what we were doing and what we planned to do with the stand-up festival. But I was watching the jazz festival, the Cork Jazz Festival at the time, and I remember thinking, that's of huge scale. What could we do in Kilkenny that would be linked to what we do and also be kind of, I suppose, unique to Ireland? And so hit upon the idea of a stand-up comedy festival, and then campaigner Claire Watson went off to Montreal to the big comedy festival there. I went to the Edinburgh International Comedy Festival and began to see how it all worked, and that was in 1994, and bingo in 1995 with the help of Peter Graham, who ran the King's Head in London, and a guy called Noel Faulkner, because I really didn't know much about stand-up at all at that stage, I have to be honest, so relied on a lot of help. And an American guy called Michael McCarthy, who was friends with George Wendt, Norm from Cheers, who came in the first year and really kind of gave us a great starting point and an angle for publicity and everything. And off we went.
Now, from the point of view of the public, these are all very funny people. Is it funny dealing with them?
Well, no. I mean, it's not particularly funny dealing with them. But at the same time, our festival, we ran our festival the way you might approach an arts festival. I mean, it had and has continued to have, I suppose, commercial potential, but we approached it the way, I suppose, like, we wanted it not just to be a good festival. If I'm being honest, you know, myself and Lynn wanted it to be, if it wasn't going to be the best festival in the world, it's certainly the most loved festival in the world, I suppose. And the way you do that is by looking after the stand-up comedians, looking after the artists. And I suppose Lynn, being an actress herself, and me dabbling with it before I became a producer, we were very artist-focused. So we made sure that we paid them actually pretty well for 20-minute sets. And we also really looked after them. We didn't have any press, really. We didn't have any television, and we didn't have any awards. So it was really coming to Kilkenny to Cat Laughs for the sake of doing what they loved doing. And, you know, I suppose it was rare to get headliners all sharing a bill, doing 20 minutes each. I mean, it's funny listening to Dylan and Tommy there, but, you know, Kilkenny was probably the only place where you could say you'd see Dylan or Tommy on a bill with Louis C.K. or Michael McIntyre all doing like 20 minutes each. So that's kind of what gave us our, there was nothing to play for. There was no big prize at stake, just the prize of doing really good stand-up in a fantastic place.
So they're all on their holidays having a bit of relaxing time.
Exactly, you said it.
Well, in terms of some of the big acts you brought in, I presume there were times when it didn't go so well. Tell us about Bill Murray.
Well, Bill Murray... I mean, that was in 1996. That was our second year. And
Bill Murray is the actor as well as the comedian.
The actor,
right?
as well as the comedian. And he came over with his two brothers because he loves golf. And so we kind of sold him the idea of Kilkenny and Mount Juliet. And it was just, it was one of those bizarre things where he came in with his brothers on Aer Lingus to do the Late Late Show. And he came in a bit early. And I had forgotten to book. I'd booked him into Juries, but I'd forgotten to book for an early booking. So picked him up. They were jet lagged, took him to Juries. There was no room ready. And I said, I just looked at him and said, look at this guy. It's Bill Murray. You must find somewhere. He said, listen, we have literally no rooms. So I ran down to the Barclay Court around the corner. And I said, look, we've got Bill Murray here. Please, just anything, a room, please, some rooms. Nothing. So I went back. They found a corridor with a sofa. So literally, Brian Doyle Murray, his older brother, was lying across that. Bill was there. I'd literally known him for half an hour at this stage. And so cups of coffee and stuff were arriving. And then something else had to come when he eventually got his room, which didn't arrive. He did the Late Late Show the following day. There was some other issue. And then he was meant to get his rental car to go and rehearse with his two brothers. And then the rental car didn't show up. And then when it showed up, it was the wrong size. And then eventually we got a proper rental car and he got into it and to drive away. And I was there waving him goodbye, and he literally unrolled, rolled down the window, looked out at me. And it was really one of those weird things, George, because he didn't say anything, but his look said everything. And the look was, I'm Bill Murray, you really messed up. I think you're all right. Don't mess up again. And it was all contained in that one look. It was magnificent. Never forget it.
It sounded like something from Fawlty Towers there.
It was really.
I wonder where Sybil was and all of that.
Yeah. That was Lynn.
I mean, you've obviously met some great personalities down through the years. Who's your most memorable or favourite of all of those comedians? Is it possible?
It's not really possible. I mean, you have favourite moments, favourite gigs, but you really have to be there to experience it in a sense. You know, what would be fun for me, you know, everybody had their favourite moments. But I would say that a lot of comedians do talk about the fact that some of their favourite gigs have been in Kilkenny, and that's always nice to hear. I mean, probably my personal favourite was a comedian, a sort of a Kurt Cobain of comedy, who sadly died, called Mitch Hedberg, who was a brilliant stand-up comedian. And he pottered onto the Watergate stage in 1997 with Dylan Moran and did one of the best gigs I've ever seen in my life. And he's much missed and much loved by the other comics. And of course, you've got to remember in 1997, you could kind of deliver special things to other Irish comedians because the internet was not the big thing it is now. So people didn't know comedians in the way they do now. You know, the world of comedy hadn't shrunk the way it has now. So you would literally, you'd see comedians going to see other comedians they hadn't seen before. And Mitch Hedberg was definitely the massive hit of 1997 and one of the best stand-ups I have ever heard in my life.
You know, the way you said there's no press and there's no television cameras, do you record any of it? Like, because I presume this is a wealth of material. If you had recorded it, you could be feeding off that for a long time with DVDs and recordings and so on. What happens with all of the acts? Do any of them get preserved like that?
Well, no, you don't. I mean, I think one of the things that, you know, when you stick a camera at a gig, in a gig, it changes the dynamic, not only for the comedian, but also for the audience who are quite sensitive to the fact that it's being filmed. So we didn't really want that. I mean, I wanted the gig. Each gig is kind of, I mean, it's kind of lovingly attended to. It may not look that to the audience, but we really do take care over each one in terms of how we structure it and shape it and how Nisha and Eddie and Rebecca, who are artistic directors who followed me, have planned each gig. We really do take care over it. And I think, you know, it does change it when you film it. So the answer is no. And we did do a documentary with Dom Herrera, which we've still, I mean, we're so terrible. You know, we're so rubbish at it. We've filmed it and we haven't cut it together. And that's about 4 years ago. But Dom Herrera is this fantastic American comedian who's been to 18 of the 20. And he's just a wonderful kind of ambassador for us. And he's a very well-known and a famous comedian in the States. So the answer is, George, not really. But I suppose with Sky coming involved now, that's been really good in terms of an involvement of the industry around the shows. So we don't interfere with the shows, but there's a bit of business growing up around the shows, which is actually what more and more Irish comedians particularly want from the festival now.
Well, 20 years is a long time. If you go back 20 years, so the issue of money and how this was going to work, the economics of it must have been terrifying. Were you always in the money with this?
No, we were also. I mean, it's very funny, actually. I remember myself and Lynn, we were doing a deal. We had a John Crowley play called Double Helix, and we were doing a deal with the Abbey Theatre at the time, the National Theatre, to go into the Peacock. And at the same time, our first year we'd done with Smithwick's Guinness, and Kilkenny was a Guinness city at the time and sort of owned by Guinness in a way. And what had happened is that after the first festival, we lost so much money, but I knew that the festival was going to go well because the feedback was fantastic. But we had lost so much money that Guinness themselves were kind of very nervous, I think, about committing again again. And I kept going, look, we're going to commit. Please commit. And they didn't want to. So I'd done a deal then with a guy called David Ford from Murphy's, who rang me. I remember speaking from a phone box in Galway and doing the deal for £40,000, which was actually a lot of money in 1995. And so nobody believed me in Kilkenny. Nobody believed me in Guinness. And I went back and I said to Eamon Langton, I sat down with him and I said, look, I've done this deal. And he looked at me, he said, are you serious? I said, I'm serious. He said, oh, that's going to create trouble. So, but ourselves and Murphy's released this statement and suddenly all hell broke loose. And suddenly we were being offered like, honestly, phenomenal amounts of money. And I remember getting an offer from Guinness and an offer from the Abbey, the National Theatre, on the same day. And myself and Lynn were laughing because we had an offer from the National Drink Company and the National Theatre, and both of us were on the dole at the time. And I remember thinking, this is a very surreal and special moment. It was the only time in my life I've been kind of at the centre of a Dutch auction, I suppose. But my feeling at the time was, if I'd gone with Guinness and the phenomenal amount of money and all of that, then I think they would have owned us and they could have closed us down if they had so wanted. But by sticking with Murphy's, we got like 10 fantastic years from them. So long term, it really worked out for us.
Well, it sounds like it. Well, this is your 20th year now, so this is a special year for you.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I mean, I don't really like marking. Well, you know, you mark them, I suppose, or other people mark them. But to me, you can't get too caught up in all that. It's just another year. But having said that, of course, we call it the 20th year and we're all excited about it. And we're selling it and also attracting the best comedians to come to it. But it's just another year.
Well, what's another year, as they say? That was a pretty winning thing as well. But just, I suppose, just to bring you back, and I suppose you mentioned Mitch Hedberg, just especially for you, Richard, we have this particular clip, which will take us to the break. This is Mitch Hedberg, the American comedian, who unfortunately, I think, died in about 2005 at a very young age.
I think Bigfoot is blurry. That's the problem. It's not the photographer's fault. Bigfoot is blurry, and that's extra scary to me because there's a large out-of-focus monster roaming the countryside. You only go to a restaurant on the weekends, it gets busy, so they got to start a waiting list. They start calling out names. They say, like, Dufresne, party of two. Table ready for Dufresne, party of two. And if no one answers, they'll say the name again. Dufresne, party of two. But then if no one answers, they'll just go right on to the next name. Bush, party of three. Yeah, but what happened to the Dufresnes? No one seems to care. Who can eat at a time like this? People are missing. You people are selfish. The Dufresnes are in someone's trunk right now with duct tape over their mouth. And they're hungry. That's a triple whammy. We need help. Bush, search party of three. You can eat once you find the Dufresnes. Thank you.
RTE Radio 1.